Disc 4. During this period, Washington was at least marginally aware of Hamilton. An exacting captain, Hamilton ordered the arrest of a sergeant, two corporals, and a private for mutiny, and they received mild punishments in a court-martial. Washington pardoned the two principal offenders before issuing general orders for Hamilton to assemble his company on May 15, 1776, at 10 o'clock next Sunday morning upon the common. A month later, as we learn from the Royal Danish American Gazette, Hamilton gallantly led a nighttime attack of 100 men against the Sandy Hook Lighthouse outside New York Harbor. I continued the attack for 2 hours with field pieces and small arms, the war correspondent cum artillery captain reported, being all that time between two smart fires from the shipping and the lighthouse, but could make no impression on the walls. Hamilton did not lose any men and said the raid miscarried because he lacked sufficient munitions and because the enemy had been tipped off to the attack. With the speed of youthful dreams, Hamilton had moved from the fantasy to the reality of combat leadership. Back in Manhattan, the young captain found a city engaged in a spree of wanton violence against Tory sympathizers. Many loyalists were subjected to a harrowing ritual known as riding the rail, in which they were carried through the streets, sitting astride a sharp rail borne by two tall, strong men. The prisoners' names were proclaimed at each street corner as spectators lustily cheered their humiliation. One bystander reported, "We had some grand Tory rides in the city this week. Several of them were handled very roughly, being carried through the streets on rails, their clothes torn off their backs, and their bodies pretty well mingled with the dust. There is hardly a Tory face to be seen this morning." Because New York had been a citadel of Tory sentiment, there was a pervasive fear of clandestine plots being hatched against Washington, whose capture or assassination would have been an inestimable prize to the British. Indeed, the former New York governor, William Tryon, tried to orchestrate just such a plan. On June 21st, as Hamilton returned from Sandy Hook, a cabal to murder General Washington and recruit a loyalist force to aid the British was laid bare. New York's Tory mayor, David Matthews, was charged with dangerous designs and treasonable conspiracies against the rights and liberties of the United Colonies of America. Others implicated in this shocking plot included several members of Washington's personal guard, especially Sergeant Thomas Hickey. Mayor Matthews admitted to having contact with the British and was imprisoned in Connecticut, but a defiant Hickey produced no witnesses at his court-martial and was sentenced to death. Hamilton regaled his St. Croix readers with these dramatic events, telling them that a most barbarous and infernal plot has been discovered among our Tories. He sketched a widespread conspiracy, the goal of which was to murder all the staff officers, blow up the magazines, and secure the passes of the town. On June 28th, nearly 20,000 spectators, virtually every person still in town, Hamilton included, turned out in a meadow near the Bowery to watch Thomas Hickey mount the gallows. The prisoner had remained unrepentant, and Washington decided to make an example of him. Hickey waived the presence of a chaplain, explaining that they are all cutthroats. He kept up his air of bravado until the hangman slipped the noose and blindfold over his head, at which point he briefly wiped away tears. Moments later, his body hung slack from the gallows. In his second dispatch on this sensational event, Hamilton applauded Washington's swift justice. "It is hoped the remainder of those miscreants now in our possession will meet with a punishment adequate to their crimes." Hamilton might have ended his dispatch there. Instead, in a curious non sequitur, the future Treasury Secretary reported rumors that copper coins made with base metal alloys would be called in, possibly replaced by new continental copper coins of larger size. Evidently, the young captain was boning up on monetary policy. Within days of Hickey's execution, King George III revealed just how far he was prepared to go to crush his refractory colonies. The world's foremost naval power began to gather a massive armada of battleships and transports at Sandy Hook, the prelude to the largest amphibious assault of the 18th century. An assemblage of military might was soon marshaled, some 300 ships and 32,000 men, including 8,400 Hessian mercenaries, a fighting force designed expressly to intimidate the Americans and restore them to their sanity through a terrifying show of strength. The British had so many troops stationed aboard this floating city that they surpassed in numbers the patriotic soldiers and citizens left facing them in New York. Entrenched in southern Manhattan, with fewer than 20,000 inexperienced soldiers at his disposal, and lacking even a single warship, Washington must have wondered how he could possibly defeat this well-oiled fighting machine. He was making every preparation for an imminent assault, he wrote, but conceded that his army was extremely deficient in arms and in great distress for want of them. To remedy a grave shortage of ammunition, the New York Provincial Congress ordered that lead be peeled from roofs and windows and melted down to make bullets. So many trees had already been chopped down for firewood that New York resembled a ghost town. To see the vast number of houses shut up, one would think the city almost evacuated, one fleeing Tory wrote. Women and children are scarcely to be seen in the streets. On July 2nd, the British battle plan began to unfold as General Sir William Howe directed ships commanded by his brother, Admiral Lord Richard Howe, to sail up through the Narrows. Thousands of redcoats disembarked on Staten Island. From Manhattan wharves and rooftops, Continental Army soldiers stared flabbergasted at the interminable procession of imposing vessels crowding into the harbor. Surveying a bay thick with British masts, one American soldier said that it resembled a wood of pine trees. "I could not believe my eyes. I declare that I thought all London was afloat." Captain Hamilton and his artillery company, posted at the battery, had an unobstructed view of the enemy. It seemed an inauspicious moment for the threatened colonies to declare independence, and yet that is exactly what they did. Faced with the military strength of the most colossal empire since ancient Rome, they decided to fight back. On July 2nd, the Continental Congress unanimously adopted a resolution calling for independence, with only New York abstaining. 2 days later, the Congress endorsed the Declaration of Independence in its final edited form. The actual signing was deferred until August 2nd. There was nothing impetuous or disorderly about this action. Even amid a state of open warfare, these law-abiding men felt obligated to issue a formal document giving a dispassionate list of their reasons for secession. This solemn, courageous act flew in the face of historical precedent. No colony had ever succeeded in breaking away from the mother country to set up a self-governing state, and the declaration signers knew that the historical odds were heavily stacked against them. They further knew that treason was a crime punishable by death, a threat that scarcely seemed abstract as reports trickled into Philadelphia of the formidable fleet bearing down on New York. The Declaration of Independence did not achieve sacred status for many years and was not even officially inscribed on parchment for another 2 weeks. Instead, a Philadelphia printer, John Dunlap, ran off about 500 broadsides that were distributed by fast riders throughout the colonies. On July 6th, while Captain Hamilton wandered about trying to find a purse with money that he had lost, he sometimes had a touch of the absent-minded genius, the local press announced independence. 2 days later, Washington held a printed copy of the Declaration in his hands for the first time. The next day, the New York Provincial Congress ratified the document, and at 6 p.m., Washington gathered all his troops on the Common, the very same Common where Hamilton had debuted as a speaker, to hear the stirring manifesto read aloud. As the rapt soldiers listened, they learned that the United Colonies of America had been declared free and independent states. The long-awaited words triggered a rush of patriotic exuberance. Militiamen and civilians barreled down Broadway, destroying every relic of British influence in their path, including royal arms painted on tavern signs. At Bowling Green, at the foot of Broadway, they mobbed a gilded equestrian statue of George III, portrayed in Roman garb that had been erected to celebrate the repeal of the Stamp Act. John Adams had once admired this beautiful ellipsis of land, railed in with solid iron, in the center of which is a statue of His Majesty on horseback, very large, of solid lead, gilded with gold, on a pedestal of marble, very high. Now, for reasons both symbolic and practical, the crowd pulled George III down from his pedestal, decapitating him in the process. The 4,000 pounds of gilded lead was rushed off to Litchfield, Connecticut, where it was melted down to make 42,088 musket bullets. One wit predicted that the king's soldiers will probably have melted majesty fired at them. The action boosted morale in the besieged city at a time of imminent peril. On July 12th, the British decided to throw the fear of God into the rebels and test their defenses by sending the Phoenix, a 44-gun battleship, and the Rose, a 28-gun frigate, past southern Manhattan with guns blazing. Undeterred by fire from the Manhattan shore, the two ships raced up the Hudson, peppering several New York rooftops with cannonballs and sailing by unscathed. The din from the shelling was deafening. Hamilton commanded four of the biggest cannon in the patriotic arsenal and stood directly in the British line of fire. Hercules Mulligan recalled, "Captain Hamilton went on the battery with his company and his piece of artillery and commenced a brisk fire upon the Phoenix and Rose, then sailing up the river, when his cannon burst and killed two of his men who were buried in the Bowling Green." Actually, Hamilton's exploding cannon may have killed as many as six of his men and wounded four or five others. Some critics blamed inadequate training for the mishap, but the general dissipation of troops addicted to whoring and drinking was more likely to blame. Lieutenant Isaac Bangs reported that many cannon at the battery had been abandoned by troops who were at their cups and at their usual place of abode, viz., on the holy ground. Of the specific incident involving Hamilton's men, Bangs wrote that, "By the carelessness of our own artillerymen, six men were killed with our own cannon and several others very badly wounded. It is said that several of the company out of which they were killed were drunk and neglected to sponge, worm, and stop the vent, and the cartridges took fire while they were ramming them down." In other words, the men hadn't swabbed out the sparks and powder after the previous firing. That Hamilton was never reprimanded and that his military reputation only improved suggests that he was never faulted for the fatal mishap. However, crushed by the incident, he quickly learned that war was a filthy business. By August 17th, New York's population stood in such grave danger that Washington urged residents to evacuate immediately. Only 5,000 civilians of a pre-war population of 25,000 remained. With a condescension typical of the British command, Lord Howe's secretary, Ambrose Searle, snickered at the rebel forces as the strangest that was ever collected. Old men of 60, boys of 14, and blacks of all ages and ragged for the most part composed the motley crew. Washington had dispersed his tattered forces across Manhattan and Brooklyn. After crossing the East River to scout out the terrain, Hamilton doubted that the Continental Army could defend Brooklyn Heights against a concerted British onslaught. Hercules Mulligan recalled a dinner at his home at which Hamilton and the Reverend John Mason agreed on the need for a tactical retreat from Brooklyn, lest the Continental Army be wiped out. After they had retired from the table, they were lamenting the situation of the army on Long Island and suggesting the best plans for its removal, when Mr. Mason and Mr. Hamilton determined to write an anonymous letter to General Washington, pointing out their ideas of the best means to draw off the army. Mulligan transmitted this plan to one of Washington's aides, to no avail. Hamilton proved dolefully accurate in his predictions. On August 22nd, the British began to transfer a huge invasion force across the Narrows from Staten Island to Brooklyn. Within a few days, British redcoats and Hessian mercenaries on Long Island numbered around 20,000, or more than twice the number of able-bodied Americans. Following a deceptive lull of several days, the British soldiers then advanced north through quaint Dutch and English farming villages. Moving through marsh and meadow, they leveled homes, flattened fences, uprooted crops in their paths, and slaughtered the inexperienced American soldiers. They took different routes, but their common objective was to reach and breach the patriotic fortifications erected on Brooklyn Heights. Although Washington rushed in reinforcements from Manhattan, the Battle of Brooklyn turned into a full-blown fiasco with the Patriots heavily outgunned. About 1,200 Americans were killed or captured, dwarfing British losses, and it looked as if Washington's army was now trapped in a vise, with the British army in front and the East River at its back. The British had a chance to smash the revolt with one decisive blow. It is commonly said that Hamilton took no part in the battle, yet an unnamed correspondent for the Royal Danish American Gazette submitted a narrative of his own involvement. One suspects the dispatch was Hamilton's handiwork, though the author identified himself only as a member of the Pennsylvania troops. Along with Maryland and Delaware troops, these soldiers were commanded by Hamilton's hard-drinking former patron, Lord Stirling, and they displayed great valor. In the words of Stirling's biographer, neither he nor anyone else could have predicted that this overweight, rheumatic, vain, pompous, gluttonous inebriate would be so ardent in battle. The St. Croix correspondent credited the bravery of Stirling's men, who defended a weak position with but few cannon to defend them. He also explained the strategy behind Washington's famous nocturnal retreat across the East River on the night of August 29th, saying that Washington feared that British men of war would sail upriver the next day and sever his access to Manhattan. The author told how, in a cold, steady drizzle, we received orders to quit our station about 2 o'clock this morning and had made our retreat almost to the ferry when General Washington ordered us back to that part of the line we were first at, which was reckoned to be the most dangerous post. The reporter's company, stranded on a spit of land, crouched within easy musket fire range of the dozing British troops, but were screened by darkness and thick rolling fog. At dawn, the author and his men scurried safely aboard one of the last ships to slide away from the Brooklyn shore. In an exemplary act of gallant leadership, Washington waited for one of the last boats before he himself crossed the river. Despite this stealthy retreat, it seemed to the British that everything was proceeding according to schedule, and that their amateurish American foes would crumble before force majeure. Instead of pursuing the rebels and pressing their advantage, the complacent British forces dawdled and botched an opportunity that might have ended the conflict. On Sunday, September 15th, they tardily resumed their offensive with a sustained, ear-splitting bombardment of American positions at Kipps Bay, approximately between 37th and 38th Streets today, on Manhattan's eastern shore. So terrible and so incessant a roar of guns, few even in the Army and Navy had ever heard before, said Lord Howe's secretary. As dozens of barges disgorged British and Hessian troops into the hilly, wooded area, the Patriot forces lost their nerve and began to flee in undisguised terror, discarding any semblance of discipline. On horseback, an outraged Washington tried to stem the disorderly retreat. Though Washington was famous for his composure, his infrequent wrath was something to behold, and he cursed the panic-stricken troops and flailed at incompetent officers with his riding crop. Finally, he flung his hat on the ground in disgust and fumed, "Are these the men with whom I am to defend America?" Since the British dragged their feet and failed to give chase to the Americans rushing northward, most of the Patriots found sanctuary in the wilderness of Harlem Heights. Hamilton stayed cool under fire. Again, the story comes from the garrulous Hercules Mulligan. Captain Hamilton commanded a post on Bunker Hill near New York and fought with the rear of our army. Hamilton later confirmed this story indirectly when he testified, "I was among the last of our army that left the city." Hamilton showed great fortitude and did not reach Harlem Heights until after dark, having walked the entire length of a thickly forested Manhattan in a drenching rain. He was very dispirited, later telling Mulligan that in retiring he lost his baggage and one of his cannon, which broke down. He had surrendered his heavy guns, and his company's weaponry had now been whittled down to 2 mobile field pieces that could be pulled along by horse or hand. As New York fell to the British, Hamilton and the ragged remnants of the Continental Army had little notion that they would be exiled from the city for 7 years. Redcoats poured into Manhattan and went on a rampage, annihilating the hated vestiges of dissent. They slashed paintings and torched books at King's College, which they used for a hospital. After midnight on September 21st, a fire started at the Fighting Cock's Tavern near the Battery, the flames leaping from house to house until this blazing conflagration consumed a quarter of the city's housing. Nobody ever solved the mystery of whether the culprit was nature or a renegade arsonist. The British, however, were convinced of rebel mischief and rounded up 200 suspects, including an American spy, Captain Nathan Hale, who was hung from the gallows at a spot thought to be near the present 3rd Avenue and 66th Street. Much of New York had been reduced to charred rubble. Despite this, thousands of desperate Tories flocked to the city for refuge, swelling its population and setting the stage for later conflicts with returning patriots. After the humiliating loss of New York, Washington thought the craggy, wooded area of Harlem Heights would shelter his army as a natural fortress. He nearly yielded to despair as he bemoaned the drunkenness, looting, desertions in the ranks, and short-term enlistments. In pleading with Congress for a permanent army, he voiced arguments that were echoed by Hamilton and that united the two men in future years. To place any dependence upon militia is assuredly resting on a broken staff. According to Hamilton's son, it was at Harlem Heights that Washington first recognized Hamilton's unique organizational gifts as he watched him supervise the building of an earthwork. It was also at Harlem Heights that Hamilton's company first came under the direct command of Washington, who entered into conversation with him, invited him to his tent, and received an impression of his military talent, wrote John C. Hamilton. It was yet another striking example of the instantaneous rapport that this young man seemed to develop with even the most seasoned officers. In late October, Hamilton fought alongside Washington at White Plains in yet another bruising defeat for the Patriots. The war was beginning to look like a farcical mismatch. The Patriots were a slovenly, dejected bunch, while the Redcoats, in their trim uniforms and brandishing polished bayonets, stepped smartly into battle to the inspirational strains of a military band. At White Plains, Washington posted the bulk of his troops on high ground while sending a separate detachment of about 1,000 men to the west on Chatterton's Hill, above the Bronx River. John C. Hamilton says that his father planted his two field pieces upon a rocky ledge at Chatterton's Hill and sprayed Hessian and British columns with fire as they struggled to wade across the river. Again and again Hamilton's pieces flashed, he wrote, sending the ascending columns down to the river's edge. Soon the British regrouped, forcing Hamilton and his comrades to abandon the hill and finally the entire area. Nevertheless, at White Plains, the British forces suffered larger losses than did the Americans, which provided a fillip to the dejected spirits of Washington's men. After White Plains, the Patriots, exposed to British sea power as well, had only a tenuous hold left on Manhattan. In the spring, they had built twin forts on opposite sides of the Hudson, Fort Washington on the Manhattan side and Fort Lee on the New Jersey side. On November 16th, as he manned an observation post at Fort Lee, Washington gazed in dismay as a huge force of British and Hessian troops overran Fort Washington. Along with staggering losses of men, muskets, and supplies, the surrender of Fort Washington dealt another devastating, nearly mortal blow to the fragile morale of the Continental Army. Washington was widely castigated for his failure to safeguard the men, not to mention all the cannon and gunpowder stored at the fort. 4 days later, the Patriots had to surrender Fort Lee hastily to Lord Cornwallis. With his army having dwindled to fewer than 3,000 forlorn men, Washington had no choice but to retreat across New Jersey, with the vile epithets of his critics ringing in his ears. Chapter 5. The Little Lion. Plagued by foul weather and abysmal morale, and with the British tailing his movements, George Washington led the bedraggled Continental Army across New Jersey. The losses he had sustained in New York strengthened his sense that he had to dodge large-scale confrontations that played to the enemy's strength. "We should on all occasions avoid a general action or put anything to the risk," he told Congress, "unless compelled by a necessity into which we ought never to be drawn." Instead, he would opt for small-scale, improvisational skirmishes, the very sort of mobile, risk-averse war of attrition that Hamilton had expounded in his undergraduate article. Hamilton continued to believe in his theory. By hanging upon their rear and seizing every opportunity of skirmishing, the situation of the British could be rendered insupportably uneasy, he wrote. The rugged terrain and dense forests of America would make it difficult for the British to wage conventional warfare. Washington had occasion to marvel anew at Hamilton's prowess during the retreat. The general hoped to make a stand at the Raritan River, near New Brunswick, then decided that his straggling troops could not withstand an enemy offensive and decided to push ahead. Posted with guns high on a riverbank, Hamilton ably provided cover for the retreating Patriots. According to Washington's adopted grandson, the commander was charmed by the brilliant courage and admirable skill Hamilton displayed as he directed a battery against the enemy's advanced columns that pressed upon the Americans in their retreat by the ford. In an early December letter to Congress, Washington, though not mentioning Hamilton by name, hailed the smart cannonade that allowed his men to escape. In yet another blunder, General Howe occupied New Jersey but permitted Washington and his men to cross the Delaware River into Pennsylvania. As he pondered his scruffy, poorly clad men, Washington warned Congress on December 20th, 10 days more will put an end to the existence of our army. With the enlistment periods of many soldiers about to expire, he needed to essay something daring to rally his despondent troops who lacked winter clothing and blankets. In his waning days as an artillery captain, Hamilton confirmed his reputation for persistence despite recurring health problems. He lay bedridden at a nearby farm when Washington decided to recross the Delaware on Christmas night and pounce on the besotted Hessians drowsing at Trenton. Hamilton referred vaguely to his long and severe fit of illness, but he somehow gathered up the strength to leave his sickbed and fight. Through death and desertion, Hamilton's company had now been paired to fewer than 30 men. As part of Lord Stirling's brigade, they were summoned to move out after midnight, huddling in cargo boats caked with ice as they poled their way across the frigid Delaware. After an 8-mile march through a thickening snowfall, Hamilton and his troops, equipped with 2 cannon, glimpsed the metal helmets and glinting bayonets of a Hessian detachment. When they exchanged fire, Hamilton narrowly escaped cannonballs, which whizzed by his ears. With snow muffling their footsteps, Washington and his men crept up on the main body of Hessians, groggy from their Christmas festivities the night before, and captured more than 1,000 of them. The fire from Hamilton's artillery company helped to force the surrender of many enemy soldiers. Patriots everywhere rejoiced at the news, which had a psychological impact far out of proportion to its slim military significance. Eager to capitalize on his triumph, Washington then attempted a stunning foray against British forces at Princeton on January 3, 1777. Another minor but hugely inspiring triumph that revived faith in Washington's leadership. As his men rounded up 200 British prisoners, an exultant Washington exclaimed, "It is a fine fox chase, my boys." A senior officer recalled Hamilton and his rump company marching into the village. "I noticed a youth, a mere stripling, small, slender, almost delicate in frame, marching beside a piece of artillery, with a cocked hat pulled down over his eyes, apparently lost in thought, with his hand resting on a cannon, and every now and then patting it as if it were a favorite horse or a pet plaything." A mythic gleam began to cling to the young captain. People were suddenly taking notice of him. "Well do I recollect the day when Hamilton's company marched into Princeton," said a friend. "It was a model of discipline. At their head was a boy, and I wondered at his youth. But what was my surprise when that slight figure was pointed out to me as that Hamilton of whom we had already heard so much." Hamilton found himself back at the college that had spurned him a few years earlier, only this time one regiment of enemy troops occupied the main dormitory. Legend claims that Hamilton set up his cannon in the college yard, pounded the brick building, and sent a cannonball slicing through a portrait of King George II in the chapel. All we know for certain is that the British soldiers inside surrendered. Hamilton believed that the Continental Army had regained its esprit de corps, showing that green patriots could outwit well-trained British troops. He later referred to the enterprises of Trenton and Princeton as the dawnings of that bright day which afterwards broke forth with such resplendent luster. With these back-to-back victories, Washington saved Philadelphia from enemy forces and gained several months to restore his depleted army. He moved his 3,000 men into winter quarters at Morristown, New Jersey, 30 miles from New York, and cupped in a beautiful valley that formed a protective perimeter around his depleted men. When a vacancy opened on Washington's staff, Hamilton was ideally suited to fill it. By now, the boy genius had been discovered by 4 generals, Alexander McDougall, Nathaniel Greene, Lord Stirling, and Washington himself, any one of whom might have been responsible for his promotion. Robert Troup ascribed the foremost influence to Henry Knox, artillery commander of the Continental Army and Hamilton's nominal superior. A former Boston bookseller of Scotch-Irish ancestry, the 300-pound Knox was a jolly fellow with a bulbous nose, a warm spirit, and an earthy sense of humor. He was already renowned for his heroism, having dragged artillery captured at Fort Ticonderoga across snow-covered expanses to defend Boston. Like many people Hamilton befriended in these years, the self-made Knox had known early hardship. His father died when he was 12, and he had become his mother's sole support. Like Hamilton, Knox was a voracious reader who had tutored himself in warfare by digesting books on military discipline and quizzing British officers who visited his bookshop. On January 20, 1777, slightly more than 2 weeks after the fighting at Princeton, Washington penned a note to Hamilton, personally inviting him to join his staff as an aide-de-camp. 5 days later, the Pennsylvania Evening Post inserted this item: "Captain Alexander Hamilton, of the New York Company of Artillery, by applying to the printer of this paper, may hear of something to his advantage." This cryptic sentence must have referred to Washington's note. The appointment was announced officially on March 1st, and from that date, Hamilton was jumped up to the rank of lieutenant colonel. By then, Hamilton was already encamped with Washington, who had set up his headquarters at Jacob Arnold's Tavern on the village green at Morristown. In fewer than 5 years, the 22-year-old Alexander Hamilton had risen from despondent clerk in St. Croix to one of the aides to America's most eminent man. Yet Hamilton did not react with jubilation. Such was his craving for battlefield distinction that he balked at taking a job that would chain him to a desk, precluding a field command. Washington once wrote that those around him were confined from morning to evening, hearing and answering applications and letters. More than 20 years later, when capable of much greater candor with Washington, Hamilton told him of his early disappointment on this score. "When, in the year 1777, the regiments of artillery were multiplied, I had good reason to expect that the command of one of them would have fallen to me had I not changed my situation, and this, in all probability, would have led further." Hamilton may have underrated the signal importance of his promotion in March 1777, for that job won him the patronage of America's leading figure and ushered him into the presence of military officers who were later to form a critical sector of his political following. In many respects, the political alignments of 1789 were first forged in the appointment lists of the Revolution. Still recuperating from illness, Hamilton was fortunate to take up his assignment with Washington at a slack moment in the campaign. The British fought at a leisurely pace, even though time worked to the Americans' advantage. Several weeks after reporting to Morristown, Hamilton told his New York associates of daily skirmishes, but with consequences so trifling and insignificant as to be scarcely worth mentioning. He informed Hugh Knox in St. Croix that for several months after his appointment, the war had produced no military event of any great importance. Yet if Hamilton sounded faintly bored at first, he took charge of Washington's staff with characteristic electrifying speed. On March 10th, he wrote to Brigadier General Alexander McDougall that Washington had been ill and that he had hesitated to disturb him. "Now that Washington had recovered," Hamilton went on, "I find he is so much pestered with matters which cannot be avoided that I am obliged to refrain from troubling him on the occasion, especially as I conceive the only answer he would give may be given by myself." How rapidly Hamilton had acquired the confidence to function as Washington's proxy. He already spoke in an authoritative voice and seemed to have few qualms about exercising his own judgment in Washington's absence. The pause in the fighting that spring gave Hamilton plenty of time to study his new boss. The superficial contrast between the tall 45-year-old Virginian and his slight 22-year-old aide was striking. Washington towered over Hamilton by at least 7 inches. This physical contrast, among other things, belies the moldy canard that Washington had fathered the illegitimate Hamilton on a trip to Barbados in 1751, 4 years before Hamilton was actually born. Many events in Washington's early years might have engendered sympathy in him for Hamilton. Washington's patrician aura could be misleading. Though the son of a wealthy tobacco planter who died when George was only 11, leaving him at the mercy of an imperious mother, Washington had limited formal schooling, never attended a college, and had trained as a surveyor as an adolescent. Famous later on for granite self-control, he had been a hot-tempered youth. "I wish that I could say that he governs his temper," Lord Fairfax wrote to the mother of the 16-year-old Washington. "He is subject to attacks of anger and provocation, sometimes without just cause." As a teenager who knew the insecurities of an outsider and was eager to earn respect, Washington tried to advance into polished society through a strenuous program of self-improvement. He learned to dance and dress properly, read biographies and histories, and memorized rules of deportment from a courtesy manual. Like Hamilton, the young Washington saw military fame as his vehicle for ascending in the world. By age 22, he was already a precocious lieutenant colonel in the Virginia militia, showing a brash courage during the French and Indian War. "I have heard the bullets whistle," he said after experiencing battle, "and believe me, there is something charming in the sound." Sensitive to slights, Washington chafed under the British condescension toward colonial officers and never forgot his experience as aide-de-camp to the abusive, pig-headed General Edward Braddock. Early disappointments with people left Washington with a residual cynicism that was to jibe well with Hamilton's views. By a swift, unforeseen series of events, Washington had been catapulted from frustrated young officer to prosperous planter. The death of his half-brother Lawrence after their visit to Barbados eventually left him sole owner of the family estate, Mount Vernon. His prospects were further enhanced by marriage at 26 to the wealthy widow Martha Dandridge Custis. Though Custis had two surviving children from her previous marriage, she never had children with Washington, prompting speculation that he was sterile, possibly as a byproduct of smallpox he contracted on the Barbados trip. Perhaps from unfulfilled paternal instincts, Washington had several surrogate sons during the Revolution, most notably the Marquis de Lafayette, and he often referred to Hamilton as my boy. Washington proved an excellent businessman, first as a canny speculator in Western lands, then as Lord of Mount Vernon. Sometimes buying human cargo directly from the holds of slave ships, he came to own more than 100 slaves by the Revolution and expanded his estate until it encompassed 13 square miles. An innovative farmer, he invented a plow and presided over a small industrial village at Mount Vernon that included a flour mill and a shop for manufacturing cloth, an entrepreneurial bent that appealed to Hamilton. Washington also brought extensive political experience to his military command, having served for 15 years in the Virginia House of Burgesses and having attended the First and Second Continental Congresses. In a supreme act of patriotism, he refused to take a salary for his services during the Revolution, accepting money only for expenses. The relationship between Washington and Hamilton was so consequential in early American history, rivaled only by the intense comradeship between Jefferson and Madison, that it is difficult to conceive of their careers apart. The two men had complementary talents, values, and opinions that survived many strains over their 22 years together. Washington possessed the outstanding judgment, sterling character, and clear sense of purpose needed to guide his sometimes wayward protege. He saw that the volatile Hamilton needed a steadying hand. Hamilton, in turn, contributed philosophical depth, administrative expertise, and comprehensive policy knowledge that nobody in Washington's ambit ever matched. He could transmute wispy ideas into detailed plans and turn revolutionary dreams into enduring realities. As a team, they were unbeatable and far more than the sum of their parts. Nonetheless, the two men had clashing temperaments and frequently showed more mutual respect than true affection. When Charles Wilson Peel painted Washington in 1779, he presented a manly, confident figure with a quiet swagger and an easy air of command. In fact, Washington was not nonchalant and could be exacting and quick to take offense. While he had a dry wit, his mirth was restrained and seldom expressed in laughter. He did not encourage familiarity, fearing it would encourage laxity in subordinates, and held himself aloof with a grave sobriety that gave him power over other people. In addition, over time he became such a prisoner of his own celebrity that people could not relax in his presence. Gilbert Stuart noted the fierce temper behind the fabled self-control, and his later paintings of Washington show something hooded and wary in the hard, penetrating eyes. The self-control was something achieved, not inherited, and often masked combustible emotions that could explode in fury. His temper was naturally irritable and high-toned, but reflection and resolution had obtained a firm and habitual ascendancy over it, Jefferson later said perceptively. If ever, however, it broke its bonds, he was most tremendous in his wrath. Those who met Washington in social situations were usually taken with his gallantry and convivial charm. Abigail Adams fairly cooed when she met him, reassuring John that the gentleman and soldier look agreeably blended in him. Working with him in cramped quarters, however, Hamilton had many chances to see Washington's irritable side and sometimes ungovernable temper. Washington was extremely fond of Hamilton, preferring him to his other aides, but he did not express his affection openly. Hamilton always addressed him as Your Excellency, and it irked him that he could not penetrate the general's reserve. But Lafayette noted that Hamilton, in turn, held something back. The notion that Hamilton was a surrogate son to Washington has some superficial merit, but fails to capture fully the psychological interplay between them. If Hamilton was a surrogate son, some suppressed Oedipal rage entered into the mix. Hamilton was so brilliant, so coldly critical, that he detected flaws in Washington less visible to other aides. One senses that he was the only young member of Washington's family who felt competitive with the general or could have imagined himself running the army. It was temperamentally hard for Alexander Hamilton to subordinate himself to anyone, even someone with the extraordinary stature of George Washington. At the same time, he never doubted for an instant that Washington was a great leader of special gifts and the one irreplaceable personage in the early American pageant. He had the deepest admiration for Washington, even if he didn't wallow in hero worship. He had misgivings about Washington as a military leader. The general did lose the majority of battles he fought in the Revolution, but not about him as a political leader. Having hitched his star to Washington, Hamilton struck a bargain with himself that he honored for the remainder of his career. He would never openly criticize Washington, whose image had to be upheld to unify the country. So diffident was George Washington in speech that John Adams described him as a great actor with the gift of silence. Washington knew that he lacked verbal flow, once writing, "With me it has always been a maxim rather to let my designs appear from my works than by my expressions." Yet this taciturn man had to cope with an unending flood of paperwork as he dealt with Congress and state legislatures while also issuing orders and arbitrating disputes among deputies. All the managerial problems of a protracted war, recruiting, promotions, munitions, clothing, food, supplies, prisoners, swam across his desk. Such a man sorely needed a fluent writer, and none of Washington's aides had so facile a pen as did Hamilton. Being Washington's chief secretary was much more than a passive, stenographic task. "At present, my time is so taken up at my desk," Washington had written to Congress in September, "that I am obliged to neglect many other essential parts of my duty. It is absolutely necessary for me to have persons that can think for me as well as execute orders." Washington further explained that his letters were drafted by aides, subject to his revision. Hamilton's advent was thus a godsend for Washington. He was able to project himself into Washington's mind and intuit what the general wanted to say, writing it up with instinctive tact and deft diplomatic skills. It was an inspired act of ventriloquism. Washington gave a few general hints, and presto, out popped Hamilton's letter in record time. Most of Washington's field orders have survived in Hamilton's handwriting. The pen for our army was held by Hamilton, and for dignity of manner, pith of matter, and elegance of style, General Washington's letters are unrivaled in military annals, wrote Robert Troop. Hamilton was loath to admit that he served as a military advisor to Washington, lest this cast doubt on his boss's abilities, but he offered him opinions on many matters. Another aide, James McHenry, said that Hamilton had studied military service practically under General Washington, and his advice in many instances, a fact known to myself, had aided our chief in giving to the machine that perfection to which it arrived previously to the close of the Revolutionary War. Pretty soon the 22-year-old alter ego was drafting letters to Congress, state governors, and the most powerful generals in the Continental Army. Before long, he had access to all confidential information and was allowed to issue orders from Washington over his own signature. Timothy Pickering, then adjutant general, was later adamant that Hamilton was far more than the leading scribe at headquarters. During the whole time that he was one of the general's aides-de-camp, Hamilton had to think as well as to write for him in all his most important correspondence. As Hamilton evolved from private secretary to something akin to chief of staff, he rode with the general in combat, cantered off on diplomatic missions, dealt with bull-headed generals, sorted through intelligence, interrogated deserters, and negotiated prisoner exchanges. This gave him a wide-angle view of economic, political, and military matters, further hastening his intellectual development. Washington was both military and political leader of the Patriots, already something of a de facto president. He had to placate the Continental Congress, which insisted on supervising the army and coordinate plans with 13 bickering states. Both Washington and Hamilton came to think in terms of the general welfare, while many other officers and politicians got bogged down in parochial squabbles. In their mutual desire for a professional army and a strong central authority that would mitigate local rivalries, the two men felt the first stirrings of an impulse that would someday culminate in the Constitution and the Federalist Party. Like Washington, Hamilton was scandalized by the dissension and cowardice, the backstabbing and avarice of the politicians in Philadelphia while soldiers were dying in the field. During his first weeks on Washington's staff, Hamilton began building a network that became the foundation of his future political base at home. He agreed to update New York politicians about military affairs and exchanged twice-weekly reports with a newly appointed body called the New York Committee of Correspondence, placing him in regular contact with leaders such as Gouverneur Morris, John Jay, and Robert R. Livingston. On April 20, 1777, when the New York State Constitution was approved, Hamilton expressed general satisfaction with it. In commenting to Morris, Hamilton foreshadowed his later views, arguing that the election for governor requires the deliberate wisdom of a select assembly and cannot be safely lodged with the people at large. On the other hand, he still showed the radical influence of his student days when he worried that a separate Senate, elected solely by propertied voters, will degenerate into a body purely aristocratical. In fact, the state's aristocratic landowners were hugely disappointed when General Philip Schuyler of Albany was defeated for governor by General George Clinton, the champion of the small farmers. Hamilton's future father-in-law was stung by the defeat, and while expressing admiration for Clinton, Schuyler complained that his family and connections do not entitle him to so distinguished a predominance. One day, Hamilton was to inherit this Schuyler-Clinton feud as his own. Shortly after Hamilton joined Washington's staff, Charles Wilson Peale visited the New Jersey headquarters and executed the first portrait of Hamilton, a miniature on ivory. It shows him in a blue and buff uniform with gold epaulets and the green ribbon of an aide-de-camp. He has close-cropped hair and a long, sharp nose and fixes the viewer with an intense gaze. He had not yet acquired the urbane self-assurance that later marked his demeanor. There was something still lean and unformed about his face, which gradually widened with age and came to look almost too large for his trim, dapper body. Quartered at Jacob Arnold's Tavern, Hamilton lived in cheek-by-jowl intimacy with his new military family. So that he could summon his aides at any hour, Washington preferred to have them shelter under one roof. Sometimes on frosty nights, the general would wrap himself in a blanket and lie thinking on a couch until interrupted by a sudden messenger on horseback. The dispatches being opened and read, recalled his adopted grandson, there would be heard in the calm, deep tones of that voice the command of the chief to his now watchful attendant, "Call Colonel Hamilton." The 4 to 6 young aides usually slept in one room, often 2 to a bed, then worked long days in a single room with chairs crowded around small wooden tables. Washington typically kept a small office off to the side. During busy periods, the aides sometimes wrote and copied 100 letters per day, an exhausting grind relieved by occasional dances, parades, and reviews. At night, the aides pulled up camp stools to a dinner table and engaged in lively repartee. Hamilton, though the youngest family member, was nevertheless Washington's principal and most confidential aide, as the general phrased it. Instead of resenting him, the other aides treated Hamilton affectionately and nicknamed him Ham or Hammy. For an orphaned boy from the Caribbean, what better fate than to become part of this elite family? Once again, the young immigrant had been transported to another sphere. Though past horrors would always lurk somewhere in his psyche, he spent the rest of his life in the upper stratum of American society. A remarkable transformation for someone with his rootless past. Unlike tradition-bound European armies, top-heavy with aristocrats, Washington's army allowed for upward mobility. Though not a perfect meritocracy, it probably valued talent and intelligence more highly than any previous army. This high-level service completed Hamilton's rapid metamorphosis into a full-blooded American. The Continental Army was a national institution and helped to make Hamilton the optimal person to articulate a vision of American nationalism, his vision sharpened by the immigrant's special love for his new country. Hamilton won admirers for his sprightly personality as well as intelligence. General Nathaniel Greene remembered his presence at headquarters as a bright gleam of sunshine, ever growing brighter as the general darkness thickened. Such comments were echoed by those who knew Hamilton in after years. Harrison Gray Otis, later a senator, wrote, "Frank, affable, intelligent, and brave, young Hamilton became the favorite of his fellow soldiers." Lawyer William Sullivan likewise found Hamilton eloquent, high-minded, and open-hearted, but also noted that he always had his fair share of detractors. He was capable of inspiring the most affectionate attachment, but he could make those whom he opposed fear and hate him cordially. With a ready tongue and rapier wit, Hamilton could wound people more than he realized, and he was so nimble in debate that even bright people sometimes felt embarrassingly tongue-tied in his presence. Hamilton was surrounded by a congenial group of young aides for whom he felt a familial warmth. He shared correspondence with Robert H. Harrison of Alexandria, Virginia, a respected lawyer and a neighbor of Washington. 10 years older than Hamilton, Harrison treated him fondly and nicknamed him the Little Lion. Another early comrade was Tench Tillman, who started out with a light infantry company in Philadelphia. For nearly 5 years, Washington said, Tillman was his faithful assistant, and he later applauded him as a zealous servant and slave to the public, and as a man of modesty and love of concord. Richard Kidder Meade joined the staff around the same time as Hamilton and elicited warm praise from him. "I know few men estimable, fewer amiable, and when I meet with one of the last description, it is not in my power to withhold affection." The following year, James McHenry became an aide to Washington. Born and educated in Ireland, McHenry had studied medicine with Dr. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia. He was able to minister to Hamilton's various maladies, including a malarial infection that recurred every summer, probably a legacy of his tropical boyhood. To correct Hamilton's constipation, McHenry instructed him to skip milk and go easy on the wine. "When you indulge in wine, let it be sparingly. Never go beyond 3 glasses, but by no means every day." That 3 glasses of wine was considered abstemious says much about the immoderate consumption of the day. Warm-hearted with a touch of the poet, McHenry wrote heroic verse and often accompanied Hamilton in entertaining Washington's family with songs. Hamilton referred to those fine sounds with which he and I are accustomed to regale the ears of the fraternity. From McHenry's diary, we can see that many of Washington's aides sneaked in romantic flings during inactive intervals that spring. In February, many wives of high-ranking officers, Mrs. Washington, Mrs. Knox, and Mrs. Green, as well as Lady Sterling and her daughter, Lady Kitty, arrived and organized dainty little tea parties in the evening. One visitor, Martha Bland of Virginia, cast admiring eyes on the handsome young aides, finding them all polite, sociable gentlemen who make the day pass with a great deal of satisfaction to the visitors. One day she joined a riding party headed by George and Martha Washington and was clearly taken with Hamilton, a sensible, genteel, polite young fellow, a West Indian. In this socially fluid situation, Hamilton could meet and court well-bred young women as social equals. Colonel Alexander Graydon recalled a self-possessed Hamilton surrounded by several adoring ladies at dinner, saying that he acquitted himself with an ease, propriety, and vivacity which gave me the most favorable impression of his talents and accomplishments, as he displayed a brilliancy which might adorn the most polished circles of society. One thing grew crystal clear at Morristown. Hamilton was girl-crazy and brimming with libido. Throughout his career, at unlikely moments, he tended to grow flirtatious, almost giddy with women. No sooner had he joined Washington's staff than he began to woo his old friend Catherine Livingston, daughter of his former patron William Livingston, now the first governor of an independent New Jersey. In an April 11th letter to Kitty, Hamilton struck the note of badinage favored by young rakes of the day. "After knowing exactly your taste and whether you are of a romantic or discreet temper as to love affairs, I will endeavor to regulate myself by it. If you would choose to be a goddess and to be worshipped as such, I will torture my imagination for the best arguments the nature of the case will admit to prove you so. But if you are content with being a mere mortal, and require no other license than is justly due to you, I will talk to you like one in his sober senses." That Hamilton was being more than playful with Kitty Livingston is shown in his declaration in the letter that the end of the revolution would remove those obstacles which now lie in the way of that most delectable thing called matrimony. When Hamilton received Livingston's belated reply to his rather forward letter, he passed it around among the other aides. "Hamilton," one confided, "when you write to this divine girl, it must be in the style of adoration. None but a goddess, I am sure, could have penned so fine a letter." In his response to Livingston, Hamilton made clear that some family members thought he was excessively preoccupied by the opposite sex. "I exercise my pen at the risk of being anathematized by grave censors for dedicating so much of my time to so trifling and insignificant a toy as woman." Though Livingston apparently had spurned his advances, he chides her apathy. He concludes philosophically that "I shall probably be in a fine way," and tells her that "all for love is my motto." We can discern Hamilton's ambivalence toward fashionable young women as he alternately flatters and belittles Kitty. As in his first boyish love poems in St. Croix, Hamilton could fancy young women as chaste goddesses or naughty little vixens. Which type he ultimately preferred, he still may not have known. In the late spring of 1777, Hamilton began the most intimate friendship of his life with an elegant, blue-eyed young officer named John Laurens, who formally joined Washington's family in October. One portrait of Laurens shows a short, commanding figure in a pose of supreme assurance, with one arm akimbo and the other resting on the hilt of a long, curved sword. He was the son of one of South Carolina's most influential planters, Henry Laurens, who succeeded John Hancock as president of the Continental Congress that November. Hamilton and Laurens, both French Huguenot on one side of their families and English on the other, seemed like kindred spirits, spiritual twins. Both were bookish and ambitious, bold and enterprising, and hungered for military honor. Both were imbued with a quixotic sense that it was noble to die in a worthy cause. Like Hamilton, Laurens was so sure of himself that he could seem brusquely overbearing to those who disagreed with him. More than any friend Hamilton ever had, Laurens was his peer, and the two were long paired in the fond memories of many who fought in the Revolution. Born in Charleston, South Carolina, a few months before Hamilton was born in Nevis, Laurens had a privileged upbringing on one of the state's biggest slave plantations. In 1771, while Hamilton toiled away as a clerk in St. Croix, Laurens's father enrolled him in a cosmopolitan school in Geneva, Switzerland. He was a versatile, accomplished student who excelled in the classics, fenced, drew, and rode. While breathing in the Republican atmosphere of Geneva, he prepared to become a barrister. In 1774, he studied law at the Middle Temple in London. This was a time of anti-slavery ferment, spurred by Lord Mansfield's legal decision that a slave became free by being brought to England. Laurens became a passionate convert to abolitionism, which was to create a strong ideological bond with Hamilton. After Lexington and Concord, Laurens clamored to return home, but was deterred by his fretful father, who worried about his son's youthful lust for combat. Henry Laurens always had a strange foreboding that his impetuous son would die in battle. After reading Thomas Paine's Common Sense in 1776, John Laurens grew ever more impatient to recross the Atlantic, but remained trapped in England by an unexpected circumstance. He had impregnated a young woman, Martha Manning, whose wealthy father, William Manning, was a close friend of Henry Laurens. With his chivalric sense of honor, John Laurens married Manning in a clandestine ceremony in October 1776. 4 months later, after Martha gave birth to a daughter, Laurens immediately boarded a ship back to Charleston. Not long after he returned, he signed on with the Continental Army and won the absolute trust of Washington, who invited him to join his family and gave him confidential missions, which neither time nor propriety would suffer me to commit to paper, Washington wrote. Hamilton and Laurens took an instant liking to each other and became inseparable. Hamilton later lauded his friend's zeal, intelligence, enterprise. As the war progressed, Hamilton wrote to Lawrence with such unbridled affection that one Hamilton biographer, James T. Flexner, has detected homoerotic overtones in their relationship. Because the style of 18th century letters could be quite florid, even between men, one must tread gingerly in approaching this matter, especially since Lawrence's letters to Hamilton were warm but proper. It is worth noting here, however, how frequently people use the word feminine to describe Hamilton, the more surprising given his military bearing and virile exploits. When John C. Hamilton was preparing his father's authorized biography, he omitted a loose sheet that has survived in his papers and that describes the relationship between Hamilton and Lawrence thus. In the intercourse of these martial youths, who have been styled the Knights of the Revolution, there was a deep fondness of friendship which approached the tenderness of feminine attachment. Hamilton had certainly been exposed to homosexuality as a boy, since many sodomites were transported to the Caribbean along with thieves, pickpockets, and others deemed undesirable. In all 13 colonies, sodomy had been a capital offense, so if Hamilton and Lawrence did become lovers, and it is impossible to say this with any certainty, they would have taken extraordinary precautions. At the very least, we can say that Hamilton developed something like an adolescent crush on his friend. Hamilton and Lawrence formed a colorful trio with a young French nobleman who was appointed an honorary major general in the Continental Army on July 31st, 1777. The Marquis de Lafayette, 19, was a stylish, ebullient young aristocrat inflamed by Republican ideals and eager to serve the revolutionary cause. The gay trio to which Hamilton and Lawrence belonged was made complete by Lafayette, Hamilton's grandson later wrote. On the whole, there was something about them rather suggestive of the three famous heroes of Dumas. Lafayette always spoke of his two American friends in the most affectionate terms. Of Lawrence, he wrote that his openness, integrity, patriotism, and splendid gallantry have made me his devoted friend. In describing Hamilton, Lafayette was still more effusive, calling him my beloved friend in whose brotherly affection I felt equally proud and happy. Eliza Hamilton confirmed that the Marquis loved Mr. Hamilton as a brother. Their love was mutual. Portraits of Lafayette show a slender, handsome youth in a powdered wig with a long face, rosy lips, and delicately arched eyebrows. Like Hamilton's, his life was shadowed by early sorrow. His father had died when he was 2, his mother when he was 13, making him an orphan at the same age as Hamilton. At 16, he had married the 14-year-old Adrienne de Noailles, the daughter of one of France's most august families, and he offered America invaluable contacts with the snobbish court of Louis XVI. His meteoric ascent in the Continental Army owed much to a letter that Benjamin Franklin wrote to George Washington from Paris, urging the political expediency of welcoming this well-connected young man. Lafayette agreed to serve without pay, brought a ship to America outfitted at his own expense, and spent lavishly from his own purse to clothe and arm the patriots. Many people warmed to Lafayette, finding him full of poetry and fire and fine liberal sentiments. Franklin implored Washington to befriend that amiable young nobleman and expressed fear that people would take advantage of his goodness. Franklin need not have worried about Washington's affections. When the young Frenchman was wounded in battle, Washington instructed the surgeon, "Treat him as though he were my son." For Lafayette, Washington became a revered paternal presence, and he named his only son George Washington Lafayette. Lafayette always had his quota of critics who regarded him as vain, suspicious, and self-seeking. Thomas Jefferson pinpointed one especially flagrant fault. His foible is a canine appetite for popularity and fame. For all his love of Lafayette, even Hamilton mocked the thousand little whims to which the Marquis was prey. Whatever his flaws, however, Lafayette proved to be a valiant officer of surprisingly mature judgment and more than rewarded the faith of his admirers. The bilingual Hamilton befriended Lafayette with the almost instantaneous speed of all his early friendships and was soon assigned to him as a liaison officer. As in the case of John Lawrence, there was such unabashed ardor in Hamilton's relationship with the Marquis that James T. Flexner has wondered whether it progressed beyond mere friendship. Did Hamilton's grandson mean much or little when he wrote, "There is a note of romance in their friendship, quite unusual even in those days, and Lafayette, especially during his early sojourn in this country, was on the closest terms with Hamilton"? Late in the war, Lafayette wrote to his wife, Among the general's aides-de-camp is a young man whom I love very much and about whom I have occasionally spoken to you. That man is Colonel Hamilton. Where Hamilton was the more extravagant partner in corresponding with Lawrence, Lafayette outshone Hamilton when it came to rapturous prose. Before this campaign, I was your friend and very intimate friend, agreeable to the ideas of the world, Lafayette wrote to him in 1780. But since returning from France, my sentiment has increased to such a point the world knows nothing about. Was this just a specimen of flowery French writing, voguish at the time, or something more? As with John Lorenz, we will never know. But the breathless tone of the letters that Hamilton exchanged with Lorenz and Lafayette is unlike anything in his later letters. This may simply have been a byproduct of youth and wartime camaraderie. The broader point is that Alexander Hamilton, the outsider from the West Indies, had a rare capacity for friendship and was already attracting a circle of devoted, well-placed people who were to help to propel him to the highest political plateau. In early July 1777, Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York fell to the British, prompting King George III to clap his hands and exclaim, "I have beat them! Beat all the Americans!" It was a potential calamity for the Patriots, since it opened a corridor for General John Burgoyne and his invading army from Canada to push south to New York City, slicing the rebel army in half and isolating New England, an overarching objective of British war policy. Livid at this defeat, Hamilton was unsparing in his censure of the commander held responsible, Philip Schuyler. "I have always been a very partial judge of General Schuyler's conduct and vindicated it frequently from the charges brought against it," he wrote to Robert R. Livingston, "but I am at last forced to suppose him inadequate." Historians have proved more charitable toward Schuyler, who was weakened by desertions and the settled malice that his New England troops bore against him as a New York leader and a tough disciplinarian. The British had also pulled off a masterful plan by scaling the steep mountain that overlooked Ticonderoga, permitting its unlikely capture. After suffering many slurs, Schuyler was replaced as head of the Army's Northern Department by Horatio Gates, whom he jeered at as the idol of the New Englanders. Even though he was exonerated for the loss of Ticonderoga in a subsequent court-martial that he himself demanded, Schuyler never completely recuperated from the wounding debacle. In Hamilton's upset over Ticonderoga, one can see that this stateless young man had developed proprietary feelings toward New York. He told Livingston that he was disturbed by the threat to a state which I consider in a great measure as my political parent. "I agree with you that the loss of your state would be a more affecting blow to America than any that could be struck by Mr. Howe to the southward." The reference to your state suggests, however, that if Hamilton already identified with New York, he still had not committed himself irrevocably to any allegiance to it. Hamilton already showed a solid grasp of military strategy. As he surveyed the British forces that summer, he hazarded several predictions that later sounded clairvoyant. First, he thought Burgoyne would be tempted to move down the Hudson toward New York. The enterprising spirit he has credit for, I suspect, may easily be fanned by his vanity into rashness, and that this would prove ruinous for him unless Sir William Howe rushed redcoats north from New York City to beef up his forces. He didn't think Howe would be that smart, however, the British having generally acted like fools. Instead, he prophesied, again with startling accuracy, that Howe would undertake a bold effort against our main army and rashly try to seize Philadelphia. In an era of primitive communications, even a massive armada could vanish at sea for long stretches. When General Howe departed from New York Harbor in late July, commanding 267 ships and 18,000 soldiers, he dropped out of sight, materialized in Delaware Bay a week later, disappeared again, then resurfaced in the bay in late August. Hamilton was spoiling for a fight to thwart Howe's entrance into Philadelphia and told Governor Morris in rousing tones, "Our army is in high health and spirits. I would not only fight them, but I would attack them, for I hold it an established maxim that there is 3-1 in favor of the party attacking." That Hamilton was much too sanguine became woefully evident on September 11th during a bloody clash between British and American troops at Brandywine Creek outside of Philadelphia. Despite stout-hearted resistance by the Patriots, the savage fighting ended in a panic-stricken rout and terrible slaughter, with a final tally of 1,300 Americans killed, wounded, or captured, twice the losses inflicted on the British. It now seemed futile to try to halt a British advance upon the capital. Washington dispatched Hamilton, Captain Henry Light Horse Harry Lee, father of Robert E. Lee, and 8 cavalrymen to burn flour mills on the Schuylkill River before they fell into enemy hands. While Hamilton and others were destroying flour at Davisers, or Diversers, Ferry, their sentinels fired a warning shot indicating the approach of British dragoons. To guarantee an escape route, Hamilton had moored a flat-bottomed boat at the river's edge. He and 3 comrades now leaped into the craft and pushed off from shore, while Lee and others took off on horseback. Lee recalled the British raking Hamilton's boat with repeated volleys from their carbines, killing one of Hamilton's men and wounding another. All the while, the intrepid Hamilton was struggling against a violent current increased by the recent rains. Hamilton and his men finally dove from the boat into the swirling waters and swam to safety. Scarcely stopping for breath, Hamilton dashed off a message to John Hancock that urged the immediate evacuation of the Continental Congress from Philadelphia. Just before Hamilton returned to headquarters, Washington received a letter from Captain Lee announcing Hamilton's death in the Schuylkill. There were tears of jubilation as well as considerable laughter when the sodden corpse himself sauntered through the door. After the Continental Congress adjourned that night, John Hancock read Hamilton's letter predicting that the enemy might pounce on Philadelphia by daybreak. Many members decided to abandon the city and exited post-haste after midnight. In his diary, John Adams told of being awakened at 3 a.m. and informed of Hamilton's dire forecast. Adams grabbed his belongings, mounted his horse, and sped away with other congressmen before dawn. Congress was chased like a covey of partridges from Philadelphia to Trenton, from Trenton to Lancaster, Adams wrote with his usual gift for evocative language. It turned out that Hamilton's warning had been premature, as the British stalled for more than a week before entering the city. Washington took advantage of this interlude to refurbish his troops, who were desperately short of blankets, clothing, and horses. With reluctance, he invested Hamilton with tyrannical powers and placed 100 men at his disposal, authorizing him to requisition supplies from Philadelphia residents. It was an assignment of the utmost gravity, and Washington feared that if it miscarried, it would involve the ruin of the army and perhaps the ruin of America. As his orders to Hamilton specified, "Painful as it is to me to order, and as it will be to you to execute the measure, I am compelled to desire you immediately to proceed to Philadelphia and there procure from the inhabitants contributions of blankets and clothing and materials to answer the purposes of both. This you will do with as much delicacy and discretion as the nature of the business demands." This extraordinary grant of power to his 22-year-old aide demanded of him both exquisite tact and unyielding firmness. In a war being fought for democracy, the preservation of popular support was all important. Hamilton had to impose discipline and importune citizens with sufficient tact to arouse sympathy instead of resentment. His training as a clerk helped him to keep careful accounts and issue receipts to residents. Washington wanted him to evacuate any horses that could be commandeered by the British, and Hamilton drew up a sensible list of the people who should be exempt from the edict: the poor, the transient, those about to leave the city, and those dependent on horses for their livelihood. Working at a non-stop pace for 2 days, Hamilton loaded up so many vessels with military stores and sent them up the Delaware with so much vigilance that very little public property fell with the city into the hands of the British general, wrote John Marshall, later Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Aided by these supplies, Washington engaged the British at Germantown on October 4th. Although another 1,000 patriots were killed, wounded, or captured, General Howe was at least pinned down in Philadelphia and prevented from moving north to reinforce General Burgoyne. In many ways, Gentleman John A. Burgoyne, a dissolute, vainglorious man who was fond of mistresses and champagne and craved a knighthood, was more suited for the pleasures of peace than the arts of war. The renowned British actor David Garrick had starred in his play The Maid of the Oaks in Drury Lane. Burgoyne and his army marched down the Hudson Valley in early October 1777 with all the cumbersome pomp of royalty. As if proceeding to a coronation, not a battle, Burgoyne loaded up no fewer than 30 carts with his personal belongings, dragged by horses through fly-ridden bogs and swamps. Burgoyne epitomized the snobbery rife among the British officers. If anything, he believed that the British had shown too much clemency toward the American upstarts. "I look upon America as our child," he had said in 1774, "which we have already spoiled by too much indulgence." The original British battle plan for severing New England from other rebel colonies had envisioned Burgoyne's force from the north converging with that of Lieutenant Colonel Barrymore St. Leger from the west and General Howe from the south. Instead, with Howe in Philadelphia, Burgoyne found himself fighting alone, isolated in the upper Hudson Valley against Patriot troops led by General Horatio Gates. Burgoyne's surrender of his entire army of 5,700 men at Saratoga in mid-October was the pivotal moment of the war, a victory so large, so thrilling, and so decisive that it emboldened the wavering France to enter the conflict on the patriotic side. The victory meant that Washington could siphon off some of Gates's troops to strengthen his own shaky position to the south. End of Disc 4.